So as we begin the class today, we're in day seven of our 7-day scenario, where the scenario that I painted was Jesus comes and sits down beside you in your living room, says, "Hey, I'm coming back in 7 days. Bye." And I ask you at that time to fill out a piece of paper on the things that you would do for these seven
Now,
remaining days.
I thought you said you added something on there. You couldn't tell nobody.
And you couldn't tell nobody. Well, you could, but I don't think nobody believed you, right? So, as we went through these weeks, I hope you referred back to that and see how that list would have worked out for you for 7 days. So now it's day seven. David Jeremiah wrote this. He says, "This is the day that the Lord has made, the crowning day, the trumpet day. It could have been any moment now, any tick of the clock, so be ready. It overpowers our imagination to think about it, but let's try. I think there'll be an abrupt change in the air and a blare of the trumpet heard instantaneously around the world. Our fingers will fly to the volume to control the radios, but then with a whoosh, a reverse gravity that we can't resist, our surroundings will disappear around us and our hearts will be filled with the joy and of this leaving this world. Goodbye, world. Goodbye, sickness. Goodbye, sin and sorrow. Goodbye, houses and land. Goodbye, tears. Hello, Jesus." In 2 Timothy 4:8, the Apostle Paul says that this is the reward of those who waiting and who loved his appearing. So as we wait for the final sands to throw through the hourglass, we can truly say we love the promise and predictions of the second coming. Jesus could have returned without telling us in advance. Being God, he can do whatever he pleases, but he saw fit to pack the Bible with prophetic insights about the future. According to John Wesley White, there's 1,845 verses in the Bible devoted to the second coming of Jesus Christ. Jesus knew we needed something to look forward to, and he knew we needed specific information about the future, for it's impossible to live without hope. So as we go into class today, I want to tell you what we're going to talk about today. And we're going to talk about believing in the resurrection as it really is the driving force about why we're sitting here today. Because I'll ask each one of you, and I think you agree, would you be sitting in this room today if there was no resurrection? I'm a bit late. Yeah. Somewhere, right?
Well, I mean, maybe so, though. I mean, it's kind of like, what would you be if you weren't a Christian?
Yeah.
You know?
So. I want to ask that question in a little while, and I want you to think about that. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Everybody's heard of Socrates, right? Socrates, considered one of the greatest teachers that ever lived. He lived about 400 years before the birth of Christ. As he was dying and his friends was coming and visiting, it was recorded that one of his friends asked this question: "Will we live again?" Said Socrates looked up at the ceiling, and his answer was, "I hope so, but no one really knows."
That's not true.
I agree. And you think about him answering that, and but then you go to the Bible and you remember what Job asked. When a man dies, will he live again? Job asked that question. And I think, you know, if you look in the world today, and especially you see people, I'm gonna say the unsaved, for the lack of a better term, would you think that might be a common question? Would it be a common question after they hear a testimony by us or a message by a pastor? All right. And it is an important question. And it's one that's the basis of what we believe. And we're going to get into that. That question, in my mind, tests every religion that there is in the world. It's the litmus test for whatever beliefs you have. Right. So, because if your beliefs only means that you're good while you're on earth, quote, I don't cut the mustard to me. That's not where it's at. Most crucial question of ages. Many people know and are terrified of death for that specific situation. And if you look at our religion, Christianity, it's the sole reason that we celebrate Easter, right? So Easter is the crux, the basis of our beliefs. So, I mean, without crucifixion, Christianity just, I mean, without resurrection, Christianity doesn't have anything, right? It's empty. But Christianity settles all this. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is the center core of what we believe. And there's many people recorded about dying a martyr's death, but only one has come back from the grave through the resurrection. And it's the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Christianity's own religion based on the resurrection of its leader. And it's not a fact. Obviously, it's a waste of time. As Paul told the Corinthians, if Christ is not raised, our preaching is in vain. Without our beliefs, without that, it's a joke. It's empty. It's like rubbing the belly of a statue. It would be nothing. We truly would be wasting our time. What we believe we believe it's what Jesus did and what followed his death and then the following resurrection is why he came to earth. Many have tried to just prove this fact. If you go back and you research over and over and over again, you read where scholars have went in and tried to disprove the fact first that Jesus was even here. And then that he truly didn't have, you know, he truly was not resurrected from the grave. And there's a large majority of these scholars who tried to prove that ended up becoming Christians. A lot of them did in this. And there's some that obviously didn't. Frank Morrison decided he would dedicate his life to proving that it was all a fake. And he was the one that became a Christian. And he said he discovered it was so powerful he couldn't disprove it. And he said that it just turned his life around. The more he studied it, he just realized that it was all true. And so what makes this something that we can talk to people about and that we should be talking to people about? And it should be something that was at the top of our list that we made up 8 weeks ago. And that is to spread the word of Jesus Christ and to speak to those who are unsaved. Is it on everybody's list? I would hope so, right? So I want to talk about three things here I'm going to call it levels of proof. And some you may relate to, and obviously there's some you can't relate to. But I want to go through this. And the first one was, you know, If we read in the Bible, I think you would agree that the resurrection was essentially a surprise to the disciples, for the lack of a better word. It was a surprise to them, but it shouldn't have been, right? And Matthew does a really good job reporting that. And so I'm going to run through some of these really quick. And these, if you want to jot them down, they're all from Matthew. And these are just a few things that Matthew wrote. Matthew 16:21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the elders, the chief priests and scribes, be killed and be raised the third day. Matthew 17:19. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, we could not cast it out. But he goes on to tell them in Matthew 17:22, he says, now while they were staying in Galilee, Jesus said to them, the Son of Man is about to be betrayed to the hands of men, and they will kill him. And on the third day, he'll be raised up. And they were exceedingly sorrowful. Matthew 20:19, and deliver him to the Gentiles and mock and scourge and crucify him. On the third day, he will rise again. And if you remember, during the Lord's Supper, the night he was arrested. And it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these things saying, he said to his disciples, I will be mocked, I'll be scourged. I'll be crucified, and on the third day I'll rise. So there was plenty of proof, and there's plenty of information for them that he was going to be resurrected. They couldn't pick it up. Remember what he told the people at the temple when he was at the temple. And it really confused them. He says, you know, you'll destroy this temple, but in 3 days I'll build it back. And all of them thought he was talking about the actual temple he was standing in. But in fact, if you read on in Matthew, he's talking about himself. So it proves Jesus told about a resurrection. And so, you know, one of the things that people can have in common, you know, and if we at some point felt like we didn't believe into it, you know, you were in good company. The disciples didn't either. So it goes along. So now I want to move on to the second one. And this is the one I really want to focus on. And I think these are all good things if we're speaking to someone and witnessing to them. And here's the proof. So if someone told you this story, then they said, I'd like you to prove it. If you told someone the story and they said, I would like you to prove this to me, what would be the most important facts you would tell them to prove them that the resurrection was true? Did anyone see him come once he came out of the grave? Would that be an important fact? There's 10 different accounts for him appearing after the resurrection. 1 Corinthians 15:6 says, after that, he was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to the present, but some have fallen asleep. So what Paul's saying says, of all these people that saw Jesus after he was resurrected, a bunch of them still alive. Go ask them. You know, if you don't believe this, go ask them. They're still around. Some of them's dead, but a lot of them still around. Look at all the appearances to the disciples. Over 40 days, he appeared everywhere to many people. And there's a lot of people that claim that was all fabricated, and you know that's true. But you know some of the things, you know, and we have to know some of the things are true whether we think they're true or not. And, you know, one of the guys that was reading this was talking about, he says, if some people believe that you could jump out of a 14-story window without dying, he says, I'm here to tell you today, you will die if you do that. You may not believe it, but if you do it, you're going to die. And he says, some people are that hard-headed to listen to something like that. And I thought that was pretty good. And it, so if you look at this from the proof of it, to me, the proof of the resurrection actually puts a burden back on us, right? I mean, it puts a burden on us. I mean, it's obviously what we believe, but it's also what we need to share with people and how we need to share it. The disciples believed it so much they gave their life to it. Now, you have to go back and look. They were a band of cowards at one point. They really were. Remember what happened when they arrested Jesus? What did they do? That's exactly right. They scattered like rats with a light just turned on. I mean, you know, the Bible says they all forsook him and fled. They wanted no part of the resurrection, of the crucifixion, right? They hid in the upper room. Jesus came out of the grave and they became flaming preachers. This is an interesting story I want to share with you. Y'all remember a guy named Charles Colson? Does that name ring a bell? He was associated with the Watergate scandal. And he was one of the main people trying to hide all this. He was convicted, right? He has now become a very prominent minister in all this.
He's deceased.
Yeah, well, yeah, he just not yeah, that long ago.
Prison fellowship
or something like that. Yeah, he converted over and became religious, and he had wrote a book about it, and he said in his book, he says, I believe that the Watergate convinces me securely about the resurrection, and he said the Watergate cover up. He said, what most people don't realize, the Watergate cover-up lasted less than 3 weeks. Did y'all know that? I thought it went on. A few years back, right? But you think about it, went on for months or whatever. But actually, it was only 3 weeks. And here's the interesting thing about this. So on 3-21 of 73, March 21st, 1973, you remember John Dean. So Dean was the counsel to President Nixon. So he went to the president and advised the president, and his quote from the meeting was, "Mr. President, there's a cancer growing in your presidency." And that's when Nixon was fully made aware of what's going on. Now, that was March 21st. In early April, just 2 weeks later, Dean decided he would go to the prosecutors, fess everything up to save his own skin. Right? And he goes on to write, and he says, when he was granted immunity, others followed. He said, think about this. He said, the most powerful man in the nation who surrounded the president couldn't keep a lie for 3 weeks. He couldn't keep a secret for less than 3 weeks. So you would have to, you would have me to believe that a band of once cowards who would spend the rest of their life in turmoil for a lie. They would die for a lie, some of them a horrible deaths, such as Peter's crucifixion upside down. Impossible, he wrote, men will die for whatever they know is true, but they will never die for what they know is false. And he says, that's the most compelling thing about the resurrection that I know of. Why would these guys, most of them, I think history says, most of them, with exception of maybe John, was martyred for their beliefs. So why would they spend the rest of their life when they could easily say, hey, you know what? It's a lie. I'll see y'all later. I'm done. I'm going back to fishing.
There's a guy named J. Warner Wallace who's written some books. The best one, or the one I'm familiar with, is called Cold Case Christianity. And he's somebody else. He was a non-believer. He worked in, I think, it might have been LAPD. It was, and his thing was investigating cold cases, you know. And he had Christian friends that worked in the department buildings. And he decided, I think one of them challenged him to, you know how to investigate things that happened, you know, murders or deaths, suspicious deaths that happened 30 or 40 years ago, how you pull back the witnesses, talk to them again, apply modern forensic type stuff that is, that techniques that have occurred since then, you know, and can you come to the truth of some of these cases? Why don't you take that same technique and apply it to the resurrection of Jesus? Or the life and death, resurrection of Jesus? And so he's somebody else who did this and became a Christian. And now, oh, he's got some great stuff. You can see some of the stuff on YouTube. But one of the things that he talks about in that book, Cold Case Christianity, is, and of course he's applying this from law enforcement perspective, of dealing with this sort of stuff, you know. And it's, what does it take for a conspiracy to hold, you know? And of course I don't remember, he's got like 10 points. I've got them in handouts and stuff that I use for kids in school. Obviously I have that on the top of my head. But yeah, it's conspiracies break down because of any one of these like 10 things, and all of which are defied by the disciples, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, one thing is conspirators have to stay in contact with each other.
Exactly.
So I got to watch you. You got to watch me. You got to make sure that I'm not turning John Dean, you know.
And every person that you tell, he had thing. Every person you tell, the percentage of success factor goes down for every person that you tell this lie to, because they're going to get involved in it and they can't keep it straight and all this. And the conspiracy to hold together, the more people involved, the less likely it's going to hold together.
Yeah. Well, you know, he talks about conspiracies hold together better if it's contained within a family. Well, you did have some brothers among the disciples, but majority of them were not related to each other at all. Or if they come from an ideological, you know, similar ideology, well, you know, you had Matthew, a tax collector, and you had Simon and Zoe. You know, they would have been oil and vinegar for sure. But just staying in proximity to each other, and whereas the disciples were scattered all over, they didn't have the opportunity to keep track with, you know, what's Thomas in India? What's he saying?
Yeah.
Is Thomas over there in India spilling the beans that none of this was true? you know, while I'm over here in, Judea, you know, saying, trying to stay true to what we originally agreed to, Thomas is over there saying something else. No, but they had no opportunity to do that. And yet, the story stayed consistent.
Well, that's what they said. They had no way of knowing sometimes for months because there was no communication.
Well, that's true. Like, absolutely. No, you know. So there's all sorts of reasons why the disciples, if it was a conspiracy, it should have fallen apart. Yeah. Should have just fallen apart. It's interesting.
It is interesting. And you know, if you look at the disciples and you look at what they were facing, and it didn't take long after, you know, when Jesus was resurrected, it didn't take long for it to start falling apart from what the Jews thought of them. I mean, it was pretty bad before, but it was really bad afterwards. And then you add Nero into it, and then all the other, you know, the Roman Caesars into it, and then it just gets worse, and you add Saul into it, and, you know, it would be easy to say, hey, you know, I'm sorry, this was a lie. God, I just want to go back and go fishing. Just leave me alone. But it didn't happen. So now then, if you look at what we just talked about and this is from the proof from what went on in first century Jerusalem and upward to today. So what evidence of the resurrection is around today? What is it around today? So if you look at Christian faith makes up a large part of the religious community. Once said, if it's not true, we should dig a new grave and throw our Bibles into it and give up. We're celebrating the resurrection. We do it each week. There's no way to explain our beliefs without believing in the resurrection. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't be able to explain it. Church is founded on Jesus. The sole reason the church survived is about Jesus and his resurrection. The first sermon Peter preached, what was there, 3,000 saved? The second sermon, it was 5,000 saved, right in the middle of all this turmoil. So it's there. It's interesting, the Christian Sunday, and I knew about this, and I never really kind of put it together. But do you know, from a Jewish standpoint, what is the true Sabbath? What day of the week is a true Sabbath?
Saturday.
Right. So the Bible is very clear about honoring the Sabbath. The Old Testament is, right? Very clear about honoring the Sabbath. So these are all Jews with the exception of Luke that's thrown into it. So they're all Jews. So now then, here they go against all teachings from Moses forward about worshiping on the Sabbath, and they start worshiping on Sunday, first day of the week. Can you imagine what it took to go there? Can you imagine what, you know, can you imagine today if one of the churches go, hey, you know, we're gonna quit having our Sunday worship. We're going to have it on Monday. We're not going to do Sunday anymore. What all could you imagine be said at that church? Oh, they quit having church on Sunday. They're going to do it on Monday. Well, that's sacrilegious or whatever terminology we would use.
Well, for that. Except they then do it on Saturday.
Yeah. And what do we say about that? The early church was all Jews, right? And can I explain the tremendous decision that was? All right. So one of the guy wrote, and he says, one of the most courageous acts ever and the one that's made is what caused the Jews to go after Christianity so violently. Jews, even today, believe they incur the wrath of God. They don't follow the strict rules of worshiping on the Sabbath, on Saturday. Most people today, when you say Sabbath, think Sunday. I mean, they do. A lot of people do, and it's truly not. Yet something happened. These Jewish people caused them to go against their teachings. So the last thing that I want to talk about is Christian ordinances. So how many ordinances do we have as Christians?
Protestants?
Yeah.
Two.
So yeah, that is a clarity for that. Yeah. Protestants. So we have two. Baptism and Lord's Supper, communion. So we have that. All right. So the New Testament teaches to do that, picture our relationship with Christ, who was crucified, died, rose again through body immersion. That's the one thing that we use for baptism. Communion is when the guy says a little wafer in a cup, as McKenna called it when she was a little, snacks. So that's what we're having, snacks today. Remembering the death until he comes back again. One guy wrote and he said, you see, you cannot go to church, you cannot sit in Sunday school, you cannot be baptized, you cannot take communion without giving testimony to the resurrection. Dr. Moreland, and I didn't get his first name when I was doing this, but he said, what is odd is that the early followers never celebrated his teaching or how wonderful Jesus was. They didn't. And what they taught was his death and resurrection. Now let's apply that to history. Let's use JFK for an example. If you read anything or anything about JFK's life, what are they going to talk about? His involvement with Russia, his charisma, right? Civil rights, how he worked with different people, humanitarian acts, and all that. That's what is going to be celebrated for anything about JFK. Are they going to truly celebrate him being shot by Lee Harvey Oswald? No. They celebrate. So if you look at the leaders today, that's what's celebrated. And this guy that wrote this went on to say, he was talking about all the leaders throughout the whole world. And he was talking about Lenin. And he said there's an inscription on Lenin's mausoleum, I guess, that talks about one of the greatest leaders to ever live. But there's his body and there's his grave. Don't cut the mustard. It don't add up. It's just not there. Last proof of resurrection is the change it made in people. The disciples were truly transformed. If you follow the disciples and you follow how they matured, I guess, during the 3 years they were with Jesus, it really wasn't a whole lot. I mean, look at what Peter did. I mean, look at the reactions. I guess if you were to pick the most mature one in the group, it'd probably been John. I mean, probably lack of anything else to say about it. He was probably the most mature one that followed. I mean, he was probably, he had more connections to it. But it, as it changes people, how many in this room would say that when you were saved and truly believed, changed your life? I think everybody in this room would say that. I mean, are you a different person that before you were saved or after you were saved? Well, yeah. I mean, it's the proof, and it's that belief in resurrection that do this. One guy wrote, he says, it's hard to explain your life before and after Jesus Christ, other than Jesus Christ. He said, that is the explanation of your life's change. He said, one of the things that we didn't realize, he says, as people, we thought that we had to be good people. And said in our hearts, he said, it's almost like you're trying to raise up to God's standards by being a good person, which all we know, we can't do that. And the only way we can raise up to God's standards is through Jesus Christ and the salvation that's provided. And he goes on, he says, you know, it's to look at the changes in the world, you have to center it on just a few things. And that few things has to do with the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So as we close up for this study, we've looked at a lot of things in these 7 days, and I hope you went through your list. I went through my list that I made up in the study guide. It tells the teachers to make their list before you go any farther. And I did. I didn't read ahead. I made my list. And what I taught on wasn't really on my list in a lot of them. And to have a list, it really is not about the list that you have. And it's about how, and this whole thing runs back around, is how we should live our lives each day. Because we don't know when Jesus is coming back. He could come back when we make it over there at the 11 o'clock service. before we finish this class right now. We don't know. And living our lives knowing that he's coming back has commitments to it. And those commitments are the things that you would have put on your list. And the whole thing about this class is that these are the things that we should be involved in each and every day. Not just because in our scenario, we knew that Jesus was coming back in 7 days. You can slash half of that sentence in two. We know he's coming back. We just don't know when. And as we go through this, just, you know, I would encourage you to keep that list handy and look back at it and say, you know, is these things the things that I'm doing each and every day? And for the majority of us, and in my case, it's not. I don't make the list each and every day, and we should. And we should strive towards that. But I hope everyone's enjoyed the class. I really enjoyed looking through it and going through this scenario. It would be interesting to hear as people talk about it, as you would live these 7 days, could you truly be focused on anything but Jesus' return? Could you be focused on anything else in your life during that time, that 7 days? I don't think I could focus on work. Sure couldn't focus on anything around the house. And it would be all encompassing for those 7 days. And that, you know, I mean, obviously we've got to have jobs to pay the bills, you know.
Well, you know, there is a phrase about Christians being so heavenly minded, they're not really good.
Good, yeah.
Yeah. But those 7 days, you'd be entitled.
Yeah, you would be. You would be.
Because you are being earthly good if you're trying to evangelize.
He's created more confidence. Than
yeah, you know, as we look, I hope I was able to pull out some things that helps you in your daily walk as it goes through and as we look at these. And the excitement, you know, that we would have in for that time waiting. I just can't imagine the seventh day. I mean, I just can't imagine waking up that day and knowing that Jesus is coming that day. That would be just overwhelming.
It'd be hard to stop like him, but.
Yeah, it would. Oh, without a doubt. Oh, I don't think so.
I don't know if he'd sleep much for 7 days.
Yeah. Hard. It's hard to realize. One of the guys was talking about this and was commenting on this study, and he said, whatever your list contains, if you focus on the first thing on the list, you'd be in pretty good shape. You would probably be in pretty good shape. Comments, thoughts? Interested what anybody may have thoughts, comments on it?